Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by Cybertrust.
Hello and welcome to this week's Netcast. On this week's show, we'll be hearing from Joe Wang, the Chief Executive and President of WatchGuard. He's recently been appointed head honcho at the security appliance maker, and while he really pushes the company line in his interview, he's got a few interesting things to say about the security appliance market as it relates to the small to medium enterprise. We'll also check in with Verizon Business Security Solutions Andrew Valentine about ID fraud and social networking sites. There's a few interesting ways the bad guys are using sites like MySpace and Facebook to turn stolen credit card data into cash. Criminal gangs are targeting lonely people with social networking profiles and using them as unknowing intermediaries. It's pretty nasty stuff. That's coming up later. But first, as always, it's time to check in with ZDNet Australia editor Mania Katadia to discuss this week's news. And Mania, we're due to get some laws similar to those in the United States which require organisations to fess up when they've been compromised.
Yeah, I think it's about time, and I hope this actually happens. The whole of the security market kind of changed in the States a few years ago when they put the data disclosure laws. So basically it means that if you have a breach, basically, and you lose information on some of your customers or people's details, then you have to tell everyone. And that really changed the market over there. And over here, you know, we've had a few, let's just say, mishaps, where the most recent one, I think, was Westpac, where they lost about 3,000 odd customer details. And I'm not quite sure why we were all told. I think that just leaked out because they had to send letters to all the people that were affected and said, your credit card had been cancelled.
Yeah.
But if there was the law, then even if these people didn't have their credit cards cancelled, then they would still have to be told, basically, that their details have been leaked.
Well, I remember back in, I don't know, it was 2001 or something like that, when they amended the Privacy Act to contain the national privacy principles. Everyone was expecting this huge sort of move towards a much more secure commercial world, and it didn't quite happen. So it'll be interesting to see what happens once this legislation gets teeth. Interestingly too, it was Andrew Walls, who was a regular guest on this program when he was with Cybertrust, who made the call, and he says it's inevitable. It's 99.99% likely to get up when the Law Reform Commission delivers a report to the Attorney General early next year. So yeah, I mean, it could be the best thing that's happened to the security market in a long, long time.
Definitely. I mean, it's going to make companies think twice about where they encrypt their data when it's at rest, and, you know, the way they look after their data. They're really going to have to be careful now, because until now they've been able to get away with it and nobody's really known. And obviously you don't want all of your customers knowing that, hey, you keep unencrypted backup data in boots of cars and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, the privacy legislation's been pretty weak and it's been criticised by many, so we'll just have to wait and see if that comes up. But yeah, certainly it's a move that I would support. So
Definitely. I'm well up for this one and looking forward to this actually becoming law.
Now, this is an interesting story, and this isn't really something that I would consider a security piece, but nonetheless, you know, we've decided to run with it because it's such a hot political issue. But the government has unveiled a $189 million porn blocking plan.
Yeah, okay, so is this porn blocking or is this censorship?
The interesting thing, Munir, is that last year, it would have been around April or May, I was actually assigned by your predecessor to write a story about that very announcement. It is not new.
It's not new at all, but it's actually progressing now, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, it's just amazing that, you know, how it's been able to dust this off like it's some sort of new initiative. I mean, they announced this back in April or May last year. They were talking about doing feasibility studies down in Tasmania, which have been delayed, and yet now I guess he gets on front of a webcam, which went out to about 770 churches, you know, including Hillsong.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting, wasn't it? He was broadcasting out this as a whole, it was a Christian thing, and it was going out to all of the Christians in all of these churches. That's a bit odd, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I think votes are votes, so it's just, he's, you know, I think he's, you know, no one could say that this definitely isn't, you know, an appeal to certain kinds of voters. But yeah, it looks like they're either going to give away software filters that people can install on their own systems, or, you know, they're going to go for this ISP level filtering. And I think that is going to be quite tricky, really. I don't think anyone's really nutted out how to filter pornography at the ISP level.
It's always been a real hassle. Now, the ISP seeming the ideal place to be able to block, they're obviously in the ideal place to be able to block bad content coming through. But then again, what is bad content and what kind of filters are they going to use? I mean, do you know any details on this? Whose software they're going to be using? Because I assume that they'll be just licensing it off one of the main guys that are already out there.
Yeah, but I mean, you talk to any ISP about this stuff and they all say the same thing, which is that they'll have to install, you know, absolutely monstrous content filtering systems that, you know, chew up a lot of resources. So it's actually going to cost them a ton of money. They say it's much more efficient to do it on the end user's machine, which is of course what you'd expect them to say, but I kind of have a feeling that they have a point in this instance, don't you?
Yeah, well, maybe. They've set aside a whole load of cash. What is it? $84.8 million into the filtering scheme. And I don't know exactly how that's going to be distributed. But I just don't know. I mean, when you go in and you start blocking this kind of content and you say, well, this is like safe for families, etc. But, you know, there's little Johnny there trying to do some research on his biology project. And, you know, what kind of sites is he not going to be allowed access to? I just don't quite know how they're going to block certain sites and keep other sites going. It just seems a bit of censorship there. I'm not sure if it's the right way to go.
And you've got to wonder if it's going to be... I don't think it's a default scheme as well, and I think that was a concern during the initial phase, was you'd have to sort of tick a box saying, yes, please let me have my porn. It's not exactly something that you'd find most people doing, but it's an opt-in scheme, so people can either download these filters or demand a clean pipe from their ISP. But yeah, this certainly looks to be... you know, more of a move around, you know, protecting votes than protecting the moral decency of internet users.
It's definitely something to be seen to be doing something rather than actually doing something interesting and useful, I think.
And really, I mean, you know, I'm always of the view that the best way to protect, especially children using the internet, is to supervise their access to it. So I think the really interesting thing is going to be to wait a year and see how many people actually opt into this filtering scheme.
Yeah, but how are we going to know?
Well, I imagine that there'll be a little bit of transparency. There will be a report. And if there isn't a report, then, you know, it's up to guys like you and me, Mania, to actually ring them up and say, hey, by the way, how many people have actually opted for this thing? So,
okay, I'm putting that on my list of things to ask them next.
Yeah. Also, another former guest on this program who we haven't heard from in a while, but he works for our sponsor, Verizon Business Security Solutions, is Mr. David Shaw. And he's come out and said that Australia's critical infrastructure is under threat due to a shortage of educational resources, particularly pertaining to things like supervisory control and data acquisition systems, or SCADA.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is a system. I know I've written about this quite often. This is a system which runs all of the... It controls things within the critical infrastructure, like the water and the gas and the electricity, etc. And it's a system which has been talked about as being vulnerable for quite a while. And they say the actual system itself isn't vulnerable, but it's the fact that now they've started adding TCP/IP and connecting bits to the internet, and that's what's making it vulnerable. So,
yeah.
You know, it's something which has been talked about for a while. I remember writing something about a year or a year and a half ago or so, saying that our critical infrastructure is going to be under threat for the next 20 years, just generally while the mindset changes. And it's going to take some time, so it's not going to be a quick fix, whatever happens.
Well, it's a really interesting culture clash, because you've got the old school engineers and then you've got the new school sort of IT guys, and they come from completely different schools of thought, and they're the ones who are at the utilities wrestling over who gets control over the SCADA systems.
Yeah.
You know, for new listeners who might not have heard this, we had Marcus Sachs on the podcast a few months ago after we interviewed him at the OSCERT conference, and he had some very interesting things to say about SCADA. But yeah, look, it is interesting to me that the idea that we're going to have to start importing experts on SCADA, which is a relatively simple technology, because we just don't have the expertise in-house, it's a bit of a worrying thing. So hopefully, you know, the government is going to invest a little bit of money into SCADA education. I know the Department of Communications, Information Technology and the Arts has been running some workshops on SCADA, but they've sort of been ridiculed by the people that I know who've attended. So,
right, is that right? What have they been saying?
Oh, just that they were sort of like, you know, this is a computer and this is a Cat5 Ethernet cable. And, you know, SCADA systems are really good and, you know, just a little bit too basic.
Yeah.
In terms of doing advanced training for security professionals, it's a little bit thin on the ground.
Do you really reckon they're under threat?
The idea that they could be under threat is enough to give us concern. I mean, there was that, you know, the most famous SCADA breach, you know, internationally happened in Queensland, where a former employer of a council managed to, and it wasn't over the internet. He used it was like some sort of legacy weird wireless system, but he was a disgruntled employee or ex-employee, and he's just sort of snuck in on site and you know, used a computer, a laptop computer, to communicate wirelessly, I believe, with these SCADA systems and open up a whole bunch of, you know, sewage valves.
Yeah, that's right. He tried to pollute the water system or something.
Well, he succeeded in polluting the river system up there. So I think that any time that you've got a vulnerability in this sort of stuff, it's a real concern, because you're talking about cyber attacks inflicting real-world damage. So,
but then again, it doesn't really matter what system he's got. If he's got physical access to it, it doesn't matter. He's going to bypass pretty much everything. So in that case, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, but I think the tighter we lock down these SCADA systems, the idea that some sort of little, you know, little spotted geek from wherever can hack into some critical infrastructure and shut down, you know, like a power plant or something like that. There was a really nice scenario outlined by Richard Clark, who was the former cybersecurity czar in the in the United States, also a guest on Risky Business a few months ago. In his book, he outlined this scenario where a hacker was able to shut down, cause a cascading failure in a power grid by, you know, messing around with SCADA systems in one single power plant. So, it scares the willies out of me, actually, Muneer. Thanks for asking. And you just think it's a bit of hype?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we've been attacked. We go back to this thing that happened. How many? It was about 4 or 5 years ago. Was it more than that?
What, the Queensland water thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a while ago, yeah.
And we haven't really had anything since then. I mean, you know, is that because they've been so good at locking it down, or is that because people aren't really that interested in attacking it?
Well, maybe it's because people aren't interested yet, and I think that's why there's concern.
Okay.
Is that there could be, and you've got China acknowledging that they've got, you know, cyber warfare battle plans basically sitting in a filing cabinet ready to go. So, yeah, I imagine SCADA would be part of any nation's sort of offense.
I'm sure it was pushed up into the front pages as well, partly because of all the stuff that was happening in Estonia earlier this year as well.
Yes, Estonia, indeed.
Estonia, yeah.
Just quickly, we'd better mention it's Patch Tuesday.
Oh, it is indeed, yes. What have we got? 9 fixes this time? Yep. And this actually includes, I believe, the Vista fixes, which have been available for a week or so now.
Yeah. So, you know, just a message to administrators out there to go and, you know, get off your bums and patch your boxes, unless you've got them set to auto update.
Yeah.
And then you just wait for all the bugs in the patches, and then you'll be reinstalling everything. Although they've been pretty reliable lately, I've got to say.
They have been. They've been testing them out and stuff. I guess, do you reckon that's why they held off on the Vista patch, or was it just waiting for...
I know there were some problems reported in that .NET framework fix.
Right.
That sort of got a lot of attention on Slashdot, but 9 out of 10 of those comments were all from people saying, oh, Microsoft's really bad and their patches don't work, not actually people who'd had problems with the patch. So
totally, yeah.
It's hard to know how widespread that was, but yeah, you know, just always worth mentioning when Microsoft does one of them. Now, here's what I like to call one of the most annoying news item types you ever get. Now, Muneer, would you introduce this one for me, please?
You're talking about the spam now, aren't you?
Yes, I'm talking about the spam.
Okay. Spam email hits an all-time high.
Now, how many times have we seen that story?
It's happened so often, but I mean, spam is still a major problem.
Look, spam's still really annoying. It's a pain in the hole. You know, no one's going to deny that. But what's amazing is that every couple of months, some completely different company says it hits an all-time high. These guys are claiming it, you know, it's something like 40 to 45% of every message sent. But I distinctly remember writing pieces back in 2003 saying that spam had hit 50% of the total of every mail sent. So
wasn't it just a little while ago that we were hearing figures around 80% or 90%? And then
this is what
down
I mean.
Again?
Look, I mean, if the security industry and the anti-spam industry wants to have any credibility whatsoever, you know, it's going to have to stop jumping up and down and putting out these press releases. And us journalists, we've got to stop writing them up.
Yeah, it's we need some sort of way. I mean, actually, I'm saying we need some sort of way. Is there any way, do you think, to accurately measure the amount of spam going around?
Well, maybe if we got everyone on the planet who has an email account.
I don't know where this is going, but it's amazing. It's amusing.
Yeah. See, I mean, that's sort of what I'm getting at. I don't think there's any really accurate way. I mean, people set up spam traps to deliberately catch as much spam as they possibly can. I mean, how anyone gets an estimate of the true number of emails actually sent around the internet? I mean, they're just numbers that you can't know. You can estimate them.
What would you say is your spam content? What percentage of your emails?
Mate, it depends which email address I'm using. You know, it's I find every email address has a lifetime of about 3 years until it winds up on so many spammers lists that you just bin it and start again.
Now, I wish we could do that here because, you know, we publish an email address on most of the stories and stuff, and that email address has been the same for a number of years now, and the amount of spam on it is just absolutely ridiculous. You know, now this goes out, I'm going to get 100 calls from people selling spam solutions.
Sucked in. Now, Carl Hanmore and I have a running bet, which is that if a month goes by without a virus, without a vulnerability being found in some sort of security software, he's going to roll up to work at Auscert HQ wearing a pink tutu. And it looks like Carl is safe again this month.
Semantic has saved him, right?
Yep.
Yeah, that's right. This is a story which we just put up about Semantic products being threatened by an ActiveX flaw. So Norton Antivirus 2006, Norton Internet Security, Norton System Works, Norton Internet Security, Anti-Spyware Edition, they're all affected.
Nice. But it doesn't affect their corporate software, does it?
That's right. No, it's just the home people.
So the home user gets shafted again. Gotta love that.
You
know.
Yeah, totally.
Hello to any home users listening out there as well. But yes, I assure you the entire security industry is looking after you and has your best interests at the forefront of its mind, not the big checks from enterprise departments. Not at all. All right, Mini, I think that actually caps off the news for this week. So thank you very much for joining us. And hopefully we'll have another bumper week next week.
I look forward to it, mate. Bye-bye.
ZDNet Australia's editor, Minia Katardia there. We'll be right back after this.
Are employees and guests bringing risk to your business? Protect your network with Unified Access Control from Juniper Networks. Unified Access Control enables you to securely open your network up to partners, contractors, and employees by creating unique access control policies for each user. To find out more, call Juniper at 1-300-458-647 or visit us at juniper.net.
And welcome back. Up next is our interview with Joe Wang, the new president and CEO of WatchGuard. Joe joined WatchGuard in April this year and has more than 2 decades of software and management experience. He was previously the CEO of Landesk Software, where he grew sales from under US $40 million to over US $100 million in 4 years. Other previous positions have included Vice President and General Manager of Symantec's Enterprise Administrative Division and CEO of 2020 Software Incorporated. This interview is an Australian exclusive, and while Joe pushes the company line here, it's always interesting to hear from a company that targets an oft-neglected market segment, the small to medium enterprise. Now tell me, Joe Wang, firewalls have become somewhat of a commodity item. There was a lot of very good money around in the 90s selling them. How has the market changed, and how can WatchGuard ensure that it's still in the game and still able to grow?
Well, it is a mature market, but there are still a lot of differences. For example, WatchGuard is known for its proxy technology, which many firewall companies actually do not provide. And the proxy technology, as you know, make it more consumer secure for the customers because of its ability to inspect more layers of communication.
Sure. Now, I'm just sort of wondering where the growth is coming from. I'm thinking with India and China developing so much IT-based infrastructure that those two markets would present possibly the best, you know, options for a company like WatchGuard to pursue growth. Is that correct?
Well, it's somewhat true. The WatchGuard growth is now mostly coming from the UTM market. And today, the UTM market is growing very rapidly. The last number or data that I saw was worldwide. The UTM market has been growing at over 40% a year, which is a very rapidly growing market, and we're seeing a lot of growth there. That said, the firewall products are still selling quite well. Clearly, in the Asia Pacific market, it's growing very rapidly. You know, because this market has been it's more mature in the U.S. and Europe. So yeah, we do see the growth in Asia Pacific, specifically as you mentioned, the China and India markets are good markets for us, and we're expecting good growth going forward.
Now, you're actually of Chinese background, aren't you?
Yes, I actually I grew up in Beijing, although I've been in the U.S. for 20 some years, and all my career has been in the U.S.
Now, I'm just wondering if that actually was something that helped. If companies these days are looking for someone who understands how to do business in places like China. And of course, there's the language side of things, which I imagine would help also. Do you think that was a factor?
Not in this particular case, although, you know, it's always helpful for someone with a global background. You know, I've been traveling in the last 10, 15 years around the world many times and do think myself as a global citizen. I think, you know, my background coming from outside of the U.S. might have helped me to become more successful in the U.S. in terms of growing in the international market. But specifically, I mean, in terms of being chosen to run a company, I think that mostly it's dependent on the history of growing businesses globally, rather than, you know, a person coming from a particular market.
Well, I think, yeah, the 1,200% return to a capital investment firm would probably have somewhat more to do with it, wouldn't it?
I would agree with that.
Yeah, okay. I guess I'm just trying to get my head around, you know, what you do when you are essentially, and, you know, I mean, I'm sure you'll disagree with this, but you are essentially a commodity provider. You're providing security appliances to the, you know, mostly to the small to medium enterprise. So I'm just wondering, you know, A, how you differentiate yourself, which you've explained through the, you know, unified threat management stuff.
And yes. So the it is a commodity market. If you look at the firewall VPN market being a mature market, but like I said, even in that mature market, you know, we do have differentiators such as the proxy technology. But beyond that, I do not believe that the UTM market is a commodity market. We're one of the few vendors that actually provide a complete suite of UTM capabilities. And, you know, how to integrate all these technologies into one appliance and make it easy for the customers to use, and most importantly, making it reliable, that's actually a not easy task. And that's where WatchGuard shines. If you look at, you know, through the years, especially in the last several years, why customers continue to buy WatchGuard products. It is about reliability, it is about ease of use, and it is about the complete set of UTM functions. And those are the things that we just do better than our competition, and we're going to continue to do better.
So I imagine you'd be getting your most fierce competition from organizations like Symantec, Checkpoint, perhaps even Juniper?
Well, we don't see competition from Symantec because they've decided not to get out of the appliance business. I don't know if you're aware of it, but they do not, you know, for a few years they were in the appliance business. Now they're not. They officially exited the market last year. We do see some competition from, Juniper and Checkpoint, but our position and their market positions are a little different, and as a result, we are more focused on the you know, small medium sized enterprises, and instead of the 100,000 nodes of type of higher end of enterprise customers.
Well, that actually leads to my next question, which is why hasn't WatchGuard actually made a play for the enterprise market? Because that's where the biggest dollars are. Or is it because you've found yourself in a market segment you're quite comfortable playing in with the SME stuff?
Well, so a very good question. We have actually purposefully decided to focus our technology and marketing on the small to medium sized businesses. Now, let me clarify the definition of that. I mean, when we say SME in the U.S., we actually meant, you know, a small company with 20 employees all the way to a medium sized company with up to 5,000 employees. Where, you know, again, here in Singapore, when I talk about 5,000 employee companies, that's actually a large company. So,
well, same in Australia.
Correct. So I just want to make, you know, to clarify that our span of technology is actually quite broad. Now, having said that, clearly we do understand the market in, you know, the enterprise market and the dollars that the large enterprises have in terms of IT budget. But, you know, as you understand the pyramid of the market, there are so many small to medium-sized companies, and, you know, we are obviously a leading player there, and the technology we provide will be tailored to that market so that it's everything in one box, it's easy to use, easy to manage, And that's just, you know, you have to provide different flavors of products, and that's where we specialize, and that's where we do better.
Do you think the small to medium enterprise market is actually underserviced by the security industry?
Well, I wouldn't say it's underserved, because, you know, companies like WatchGuard do play there quite well. So I think, you know, they are served well by companies like us. I think the higher end of the markets is probably more competitive because of, you know, the companies like Juniper, Checkpoint, and Cisco. They're all focused on that.
Yeah, it's a pretty tough niche to play in, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I seem to recall when Juniper acquired NetScreen Technologies, and they did a big push into the enterprise market, which for them was actually a step down because they'd been doing carrier grade prior to that, and I don't think they really enjoyed the success that they'd envisaged.
Yeah, I think the high end market always is likely, you know, it's crowded with a lot of players, and you know, to be honest, it's a good market as well, but so is the lower end of the market. It again depends on your technology, your sales channel, and your market strategy. And, you know, our strategy is to target the medium, the small to medium sized businesses, and it has served us well in the past. And, you know, we believe the market is growing quite rapidly there and should be able to serve us well going forward.
So who do you actually encounter most competition from in that particular market that you compete in?
SonicWall is a company that we see from time to time compete in a similar market.
Mm-hmm. But it's less crowded down there, isn't it?
It is definitely less crowded. It actually, and one of the reasons that we're quite happy to continue to provide technologies specifically tailored for the market. In fact, we're quite confident that we're going to continue to grow, and we're going to have exciting growth ahead of us.
Now, do you think, where is that growth going to come from mostly, do you think? I mean, if you could break it down by region and also by vertical, I guess, that would be interesting,
well,
I'm sure, for our listeners.
Yeah, so if you look at from the market perspective, the UTM market, like I said, has been growing very rapidly. And we see that continue to happen, especially in the SME market. You know, when you think about companies that they need not only a firewall, but they need a spam blocker, a web blocker, the gateway AV. I mean, what about one box that's got everything in it with good price, easy to easy management, and just put the box, you know, between your intranet and the outside internet, and you are set. I mean, it's a very strong proposition. And that's where we see substantial growth for many years to come.
Well, that was something that was quite difficult even just a few years ago, wasn't it? It required a, you know, team of monkeys working around the clock to maintain all of that stuff. Whereas now, you know, we really are getting, for the small to medium enterprise guys, we're getting to the point of set and forget security. Not that it's going to be foolproof, but it, you know, you can certainly get a much higher level of security out of one device than you could, say, 5 years ago.
That's right on. In fact, you know, when you look at the history of the market, the people tended to have, you know, the larger companies tended to have more concerns about it. And then the solution was to have different vendors providing different functions and, you know, to serve the large enterprise. And then a few years ago, companies like WatchGuard started to go into the market by combining all these capabilities, making it easy to use and everything into one box. And that's when the small to medium-sized businesses start to be able to take advantage of these type of technologies and to fully protect them from all kinds of threats. And that's where, you know, the word UTM came from, and that's where, you know, we have seen substantial growth in the last several years. And that is precisely what you said, which was, you know, the ability to bring everything into one box to provide an easy solution for the small to medium-sized businesses. It just makes good business sense.
What's the experience been like for WatchGuard in operating in the Australian market over the last 5 years?
Well, so in the Australian market, we as you know, WatchGuard as a company has gone through some changes, you know, specifically last year, coming from a public company, being taken private by the private equity firms and the change of management team. So, you know, I would admit that there were some management changes, and that happened in Australia as well. But now we have a very strong team in place in Australia. the good news for us is even with the management team changes, we have not suffered in our business. You know, yeah, we have not seen substantial growth in Australia, but our business has been very stable there. And we now have a strong team in place. We're expecting very high growth. Now, just so you know that our VP of sales for Asia Pacific, Norbert Kiss, he actually is an Australian, even though he's stationed here in Singapore. So we do have institutional knowledge about the market, and we're expecting, continued and renewed investment in the Australia market. And we're actually very bullish about that market.
Okay. Well, Joe Wang, thank you very much for taking some time out.
Well, thank you for your time.
Now, I did warn you, he pushes the company line pretty hard. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview. Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by CyberTrust, sponsors this podcast. So each week we get one of their experts on the show for an interview. This week we're talking to Andrew Valentine about social networking websites and bad guys. Prior to joining the private sector, Andrew was a computer crime analyst at the Florida Department of Law Enforcement's Computer Crime Center. Now, Andrew, we're hearing a lot of hype around social networking sites and sort of security and ID theft, but how much do you think that's just all, you know, empty hype?
The thing about social networking sites and identity fraud is that although the vector is different, the fraud itself largely remains the same. The reason that social networking sites are hot for the bad guys to derive information, the building blocks of identity fraud is that it's available. People that are hooked up to MySpace or Facebook, or more importantly, LinkedIn, which is like a professionally based social networking site. By and large, you're going to have your date of birth, you know, your address, your professional email, even careers, your career details around your career, your marital status, stuff like that. So these are the building blocks that people will use to open lines of credit in your name, that sort of thing.
So it really starts adding up to a fairly complete picture of identity, doesn't it? Once you have someone's date of birth, once you have their picture, in some cases their phone number, their professional experience, it does start to build a bit of a picture that ID thieves can then fill in the gaps with some social engineering, I guess, couldn't they?
That's what I'm saying. The fraud itself, the social engineering aspects remain the same. It's just another vector for the bad guys to sort of derive people's information.
Do you think these social networking sites have more of a responsibility to lock down their services? Do you really think Facebook should, for example, allow its users to display their birth dates?
The answer to your question is no, and this is why. From my end, we do basically computer forensics day in and day out. So our line of work is determining how and when card data is stolen from, merchant or company databases and how it gets siphoned out to the black market and used fraudulently. So what will happen is, say you'll have a company that gets hacked and loses about 4,000 credit or debit card payment records. Those numbers are then filtered through the black market through any number of different black market trading websites like Carter Planet or Drop Corps or Bullet Factory, any of those. What happens is these bad guys get a hold of a whole bunch of credit card numbers and need to turn those credit card numbers into cash. And the way they do that is to buy high-end electronics merchandise and then ship it back to Turkey or Nigeria or wherever. And to do that, a lot of times they'll meet people on social networking sites, somebody that's looking for love, maybe on MySpace, meet somebody online that appears to be somebody that's a romantic interest. Until that person says, "Hey, listen, I need you to let me ship you a television set, and forward that back out to Nigeria." And you see that a lot. People that unbeknownst to them are caught up in sort of international black market trading rings, thinking that they're doing somebody a favor.
True love is a reposting of a plasma screen TV, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. See cases where you'll think that somebody's knowingly involved in a fraud ring, and you show up at their house, and it turns out that they have no idea what they're doing. They're like, "Oh, I just thought I was doing a person a favor." And in these people's living rooms, there's boxes full of television sets, PlayStations, and what are you doing here? Well, I'm just forwarding this stuff off to Nigeria for a friend I met online.
Oops.
And that happens more than you think. I think with the social networking sites, there's two vectors of fraud. There's the classic, find somebody's information and commit identity fraud against that person. And the other is to engineer somebody, socially engineer somebody to help you commit your fraud and trade, stolen goods back and forth. And both of those happen, more often than not.
Well, Andrew Valentine, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, sir.
And that brings us to the close of this week's podcast. don't forget to subscribe to this podcast using the links to the left of the posts. We'll be adding a subscribe by email function to the site really soon. It's just taking a bit longer than we thought it would. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.